Iku Iluna, please rise. Ohea oko eko ka aha, nahe kuliana imu okea aha ho o kolo kolo kie kie anohana oko maku ana o Hawaii. E nai mai, e maliu mai, I lohi ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court, State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. I noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-21-000504. State of Hawaii, Respondent Plaintiff Appellant versus Brian Lee Smith, Petitioner Defendant Appellee. Arguing for the petitioner, Andrew Kennedy. Arguing for the respondent, Charles Murray. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, Mr. Murray and Mr. Kennedy. Are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, we are going to be broadcasting live today on our YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. We've allocated 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Kennedy, we're going to give you a warning with 7 minutes to go, correct, in your 30 minutes. And Mr. Murray, we will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Very well. Please proceed.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Justices of the Supreme Court, Mr. Murray. May it please the Court. The issues in this case, there's primarily two issues. The first is notice, and the second is state of mind. What is the state of mind for a 706.60.1 firearm provision? And did the charging document provide proper notice to the accused as to the state of mind required for this provision in the penal code? The court would indulge me for just a moment to give a quick hypothetical, if I may. Picture a situation where a person is walking, they pick up a bag. They put that bag on their back, and everyone agrees this person has no reason to know what's in that bag. They sit down, they start smoking some meth. Cop comes by, says, hey, you're committing a felony. Arrests them, says, can I look in the bag? Person says, sure, go for it. I don't even know what's in there. And in there is a firearm. Is that person subject to mandatory prison pursuant to HRS 706.60.1 for Class C felony would be 3 years? It escalates per offense. How should the attorney who's assigned that case, if it's an indigent defendant, how would a public defender, how would they advise their clients? How would a judge instruct the jury as to this provision? And if you, the justices of the Supreme Court, need to debate over what the state of mind actually is, then how does this charging document advise a person of ordinary and reasonable intelligence as to what they need to defend against? When this case was argued in the circuit court almost 4 years ago at this point, I posed a question to Judge DeWeese. I said, and Judge DeWeese, keeping in mind, she's an experienced criminal practitioner. She was the head of the public defender's office before becoming a judge. And I posed the question to her. I said, you have to instruct the jury. What are you going to tell them? How are you going to instruct the jury as to 706.660? And in her conclusions of law, paragraph six, she went over the various ways that this could go, the various states of mind that could be applied. So she didn't necessarily know what she would apply. This case was originally, it's an older case because it had a trial back in 2019 and it was reversed on an unrelated issue. In the original trial, the state asked for a state of mind of intentional or knowing. And this wasn't rookie prosecutors, this was a murder case. These are the most experienced prosecutors in the jurisdiction. And the judge, Judge Fugino, another criminal law practitioner prior to becoming a judge, went with the state of mind of intentional or knowing. Typically, for possession of firearm cases, the state of mind, this is State versus Jenkins, has two-prong analysis. You knowingly possess the item. Reckless disregard of the item is, in fact, a firearm. The attendant circumstance is reckless. There's also a statute that says when a law is silent as to the state of mind, recklessness is the default, 702.204. And the state is making an argument now that's contrary to their 2019 position, which is now the lowest, that there is no state of mind. Strict liability. We also throw in the issue that it's not just possession of a firearm, it's twofold. It's possessed a firearm or threatened the use of a firearm. as we know, threaten has a different state of mind. It's reckless, it's in REPP, and there's constitutional provisions such as true threat that need to be made for recklessness. So the state of mind could be a number of possibilities. I would submit to the court it is in accordance with possession as it is elsewhere in the penal code and as the courts have defined elsewhere, which is knowingly possess the item, reckless disregard that it is in fact a firearm. But the ultimate reason why this was dismissed was a notice requirement. Does it actually even have to be pled? The purpose of the notice requirement for pleading is to alert the defendants precisely of what they need to defend against to avoid conviction. So that hypothetical I gave in the beginning. The defendant should be able to read the indictment and know exactly what it is that they need to defend against. And I know the ICA made an issue between the distinction between elements and enhancements. Our position is that it doesn't matter what we label a provision like this. They still have to have notice. First, state of mind is not actually an element or an enhancement. In the Nesmith case, they say state of mind requirements are not elements of an offense, but they're required to be included in the charges against the defendants in order to alert the defendants of precisely what they need to defend against. So it doesn't matter if it's an element or not. We still need to alert the defendant as to what they need to defend against.
You know, counsel.
Yeah.
Rookie defense counsel, first day on the job, they take a look at an indictment. Aren't they given notice that they're subject possibly to a sentencing enhancement?
The way it's pled there?
Yeah.
Well, they're given notice that an enhancement does exist, but they're not given notice as to what.
And isn't an enhancement much different? And we said this in Wagner. Isn't it much different than the underlying offense itself?
I don't know that I would consider it much different in all respects. It absolutely has, like Wagner was the issue of bifurcating the trial or not. Like, do we put the enhancement aspect in the first trial or bifurcate it, send it to the jury again a second time? And I know, like with habitual DUIs, it's an element, so therefore it comes in. But when we look at cases like Alden Apprendi, which kind of set the bar for this type of case, they don't distinguish between elements and enhancements.
Well, those are priors. That's a different aspect than a fact. What would be the state of mind on a prior? Or, you know, there's a repeat violent sexual offender, that's 706-606.5. What is your view on what the state of mind on a prior conviction is?
Well, I think that can run a gambit of things. I mean, there's the more recent case out of the United States Supreme Court, the Rahaf case, that says that someone has to know their status. And it's a knowing issue, but I know here in Hawaii, with a lot of the priors for, say, habitual and things of that nature, we don't hold that there's a knowledge requirement.
What would the jury be instructed then on a prior?
I think that you would have to go a case-by-case basis as to what the prior applied to. Is it a prior for habitual DUI, prior for habitual property crime? Is it a prior for ownership prohibited?
Let's just say it's a basic prior. I have a conviction. I'm going to get jacked if it's a C felony to 1.8 mandatory minimum.
I
with one prior.
I would say no. Off the top of my head, I don't know that one off the top of my head, though. But I would say generally, status offenses, I think, I'm just going off the opinion in Rahaf, which I don't think was highlighted too much in here, is status, a person's status has to be known. But if the statute himself, and we look at the legislative history, and they specifically carved out that state of mind is not required for this, then no, there wouldn't be a state of mind.
So if there, let me just try to unwind that. If there's no state of mind in the enhancement itself, and there are states of mind for certain enhancements, elderly, handicapped, under 8, hate crime, those have specific states of mind. But for those crimes that do not, like priors or perhaps this crime, are you suggesting that there's no state of mind necessary?
No, I would say that the words used in this specific case is possess or threaten. And those words don't just stand alone in this statute. Those words have legal meaning. There's a legally operative words. Like in contracts, some words go beyond, there's a definition that everyone understands them as. The word possess is a legally operative word. We know what that means. It is in the context of a firearm. It's in the penal code. There are case law. There's cases like Jenkins that define possession of a firearm. So that would be the definition for this.
Counsel, does it matter that this is, I think, indisputably a use case? It's not a possession case. It's not a threat case, right? That's what the evidence in the first trial showed. Does that make any difference at all?
I think in terms of, well, I don't think so when it comes to notice. I think if we plead it beforehand, it has to be across the board. I don't think that we look at the specific facts. Like I think like when we go back to the Wheeler cases and on the public street or road, like those cases, they were all clearly on a public street or road for most of them. Yeah, the element was missing, so the notice wasn't there.
What about the fact that there are other counts, the 134.7 counts, reference the same incident, and there it's alleged that knowingly carried on his person or had within his immediate control or intentionally used or threatened to use a firearm. Is it possible, or should the defendant be expected to read the other charges, counts 1, 2, and 3, in light of those counts and the allegations in them?
I think each charge has to stand individually. And I don't know if that count that you just said actually is correct in how it states the state of mind for what the enhancement is on 706660.
Do we need to address the issue of prior convictions now, whether a state of mind? Is that issue before us?
I didn't raise that issue. I don't believe that is an issue before us right now.
Right.
So what's the mens rea that you're – what's the position on that as far as what you believe should have been?
So the case of Jenkins is sort of the main case when it comes to possession of firearms. And it is – I have it in front of me. It's knowingly possess the object – and then with respect to the intended circumstance that the object is a firearm, reckless disregard that it is in fact a firearm.
If this court were to decide that mens rea is required for this sentencing enhancement, the state would be able to amend the charge?
I mean, there are procedures for them to be able to do so. It's a charging language order, so it's without prejudice, and they could go through and amend it.
Is the requirement for mens rea, in your view, pursuant to constitutional requirements, or is there a way to do it via statute?
I would say the requirement for pleading the mens rea is pursuant to the constitutional requirements.
Vis-a-vis Nesmith?
Nesmith and Article 1, Sections 5, 10, and 14, specifically Article 14. The existence of the mens rea is due to, first, the legislature didn't go down the road of intending this to be strict liability. We looked at the legislative history. Nowhere in it do they clearly say this is no mens rea attached.
So you're relying on 702.204 there?
Yeah. And saying that 2012 is inapplicable. Also, and I think it's interesting with the way that Ald and Apprendi, and I know that that's a little different, but how they read is they say, and this is from Ald, any fact by law that increases the penalty for a crime is an element. And then they include mandatory minimum sentences increase the penalty for a crime. So that's this court in the Ald case. It goes on to say, in other words, Apprendi's definition of elements necessarily include not only facts that increase the ceiling, but also increase the floor. So whether we're splitting the semantics of element versus enhancement, they have the same practical effect. There's still a fact that sets a floor.
That's part of the challenge in, I guess, perhaps the case law as well, is the statutory requirements of what an element are.
Right.
As opposed to what the language is that you just read from some of the cases, right?
Right.
And your point being, really, there ought to, for certain circumstances, not be a substantive difference whether you call it an element versus an enhancement.
Right. At the end of the day, it's still a fact that sets a minimum. And it should be pled to the jury. It should be And
well, but that's different. You're talking about jury. We're talking about, you've also, your first part was notice. And hasn't this court in a slew of recent cases, Vlambeyenberg, Garcia, Aquino, basically said, hey, look, it's really just providing notice. Let's not get overly technical on these things, just to provide notice on what the defendant's facing. And if you look at the indictment, you look at count one, how does a first-year defense counsel not understand and be able to impart to his client or her client that, you know what, you're facing a possible up to 15 years for having a firearm during this possible murder?
So that's a good point. And as Your Honor knows, there have been a number of cases that have sort of tightened the reins on the pleading requirements lately. But the more recent one, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on the name. I know it's your case. And
Aquino.
Vlambeyenberg, yeah. But that says there's still a minimum that's required. There's still a minimum that you need to still state the elements and still get it out there. They don't have to define what these states of mind are. We don't have to go that far, but you still have to say what it is. So in a case like this, I mean, you reference how does a first-year law student not know, but how did the prosecutors get it so differently in the first trial versus what they're coming at in their point now? As Judge Deweese noted in her order, this could be a variety of four different ways that this could go. So if you have people with doctorate degrees specializing in this field debating over what it actually is, the notice requirement actually goes to what an ordinary person of a person of ordinary prudence and intelligence would understand. So if they see it, they say, okay, you're subject to enhancement, but what is the state of mind for this enhancement? Is it strict liability? Do you have to actually know it's a gun, or do you just know you have the object and recklessly disregard that it's a gun?
I suppose that all makes sense if you think an enhancement is actually an element of a crime, or it's simply a sentencing possibility after you're convicted of the crime.
Well, I would say it is a fact that sets a mandatory minimum. And as such, it falls within the Apprendi and all type universe of
well, all's a little bit different than Apprendi.
Yeah, but it cites to Apprendi. Yeah,
I understand. Yeah. What do you think the ICA misconstrued in terms of its reliance on Wagner?
That's a good question. I think the ICA misconstrued in the fact that it went deeper down the hole of the differentiating between elements and enhancements and finding, well, it's not actually an element, it's an enhancement. But in reality, the difference between element and enhancement is there's a practical effect in cases like Wagner and the habitual DUI setting and how the cases in the trial still proceed. But in terms of what the defendant is, the full language is the nature and cause of the accusation. He still has to be able to know that, and he needs to understand the whole thing. So whether it's an element or an enhancement, I don't think that we need to distinguish between the two, because we're still coming to the nature and cause of the accusation, which is what Article 1, Section 14 of the Hawaii State Constitution refers to.
Do you think that the legislature intended to create a strict liability situation for possession?
Not at all.
And why not?
Doesn't say it anywhere in there. They use the word possess. Possess has meanings. I believe 702.212 says it has to be clear. We don't prosecute on actus reus alone. There's a disfavor on that. The strict liability is the exception. Generally, we think of petty misdemeanors, traffic offenses, things of that nature, and of course, statutory rape's the classic one, the age of the individual. And I would also, with respect to statutory strict liability, this is something I still strongly believe. I think that should still be pled as well. I think someone should know if no state of mind applies. So the example being, say, a sex assault against a minor, where the state of mind of the minor is not relevant because it's not relevant, but it is strict liability. I mean, just thinking back as a defense attorney, people saying, but I did not know she was under 15 or whatever, right? Whether that's true or not, but then you have to explain to the individual, it doesn't matter, it's strict liability on that element. That should be pled as well. I don't think that there's an out for state of mind not being there, strict liability. That there still should be put on notice that no state of mind applies for this element.
You mentioned 702.212. Doesn't the language of that statute specifically say crime and offense?
Yeah, I do believe that's what it says. But I do think that this all falls within the same crime. I mean, it's the nature and cause of the accusation. I'll keep falling back on that, I suppose. But yeah, I do think that I hear what you're saying, but I mean, it sets the floor, has to be pled, we plead it out, you know. And going back to your days as a defense attorney as well, how would you, you know, advise your client? You know, you'd have to go back, you'd have to look it up. And
I would say, hey, you know, if you get convicted, maybe this merges. What do you think about merger here?
Well, I don't think that's what a first-year public defender might be saying, though. You know.
I understand.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, by the way, I mentioned 702.212, but 702.204 also is tethered to offense, not enhancement. How do you respond to those plain words in the statute?
I think it's the nature and cause of the accusation. I think that, and I think we have a Sixth Amendment, you know, we have the right to know. They have to plead it. They have to put it in front of the jury. So, you know, I think that the term possess has a state of mind that's involved in it. I think that the legal word possess inherently has a state of mind. I don't know if that answers the question. I apologize if it's a little sidetracked.
Thank you.
You know, under Wagner, which the ICA relied upon, which dealt with a prior conviction for a similar offense, right?
Yeah.
Meth trafficking. I just wonder if you feel like, based on your position in this case, you're advocating for an overruling of Wagner or a distinction?
Yeah, not at all. No, I don't think Wagner is improperly applied. I think in that case, it's still bifurcated. It still has to go to the jury. It just doesn't go to the jury in phase one of the trial. But I think that even in the Wagner situation, you would still have to plead it properly and it would still be there. But I don't think this ruling would touch Wagner at all. No.
Okay.
Well, are there any other questions right now?
Wait, would that be correct when Wagner said that the prior conviction isn't an element?
Well, they used the word saying it was an enhancement, and therefore it wasn't an element. So therefore, it doesn't go directly to the element. I think how they word it isn't one of the underlying elements for the offenses charged. Therefore, it's an enhancement. It does not go to the jury in the first phase of bifurcated trial.
Well, the court said the circuit court incorrectly construed Wagner's prior conviction as an element of the offense.
Right, and they put it. What happened to Wagner was they just combined it all and they did it all in one trial, and then they said, well, the prior should have been bifurcated and set out because it's not an element that needs to be proven to prove the underlying offense, as opposed to the common distinguishment from Wagner is the habitual DUI, where the prior is an element, therefore it has to be shown to the jury right away. That's really the only distinction I see. I don't see there being much difference between the word enhancement and element.
So you think Wagner's still good law?
Yeah, I think Wagner's appropriate.
What about its distinction between sentencing enhancements and elements? Is that no longer a valid distinction? Because that's its whole analytical framework, is characterizing the issue there, the prior, as a sentencing enhancement.
I think if it sets a floor, you know, I'm just going off the words in Ald. If it sets a floor, it's an element, and whether we call it element or enhancement, but it's something that needs to be proven. It's something that needs to be pled. It's something that a defendant needs to know about beforehand.
In your view,
under there. They're going to get another 15. They're subject to another 15 years. Let's say it's negligent. They kill somebody, negligently driving and they kill somebody, reckless driving and they kill somebody. So they're going to be subject to another 15 years because they possessed a gun.
I believe that was the legislative intent. Whether that's fair or not, that's what the legislature did.
Okay, so then we address the issue, is that due process then? Does that comport with due process? To allow someone to be sentenced to 15 years with no, when they had no knowledge that they possessed a gun. What about a prop gun case? You're shooting a movie and you have a prop gun, you don't know it's an actual gun. And it goes off and it shoots and kills somebody. Strict liability. Additional 15 years.
Right. And if that is violates due process, then to take Mr. Kennedy's analogy, why wouldn't strict liability when you're talking about sexual assault of a minor not also violate due process and fairness? Those are questions I think that are best handled by the legislature because they raise moral and fairness issues that frankly are beyond, you know, people that are, that's something that people should have a say in through their elected representatives.
Go ahead.
To adopt your position, would we have to distinguish Ault in any way?
No. I believe it, adopting the state's position in this case would be perfectly in line with the prior case history, both federally and in the state. It doesn't require any change or any, you know, deviation or sidetrack.
That would include Wagner?
Yes.
Thank you.
What about Nesmith, Mr. Murray? In Nesmith, this court required the pleading of state of mind. And part of the basis for that, perhaps the key basis for that, is Article 1, Section 14 of our Constitution, which says, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation. It doesn't say offense, it says accusation. So how do you distinguish Nesmith?
Well, states of mind are statutorily created under 702.204. In terms of notice, which I think is what that's getting at, if you know the crime is possessing a firearm, the state of mind, crimes used to not have state of mind, right? Like there's been a change. There's now explicit, intentional, knowing, reckless. Those are the state of mind, negligent. But when you're talking about the notice requirement, I think this goes more to notice. It doesn't necessarily have to have a state of mind as long as they have notice of what they're being accused of. Possession. If you ask a common person, maybe not a lawyer, but a common person off the street what possession means, they understand what that means to them, right? That
well,
means
maybe you're in a Mita situation there, but I'm not sure.
I think most people, when you say he possessed a gun, they picture a guy holding a gun. Maybe not a gun secretly that he doesn't know about under his car, to Justice McKenna's analogy. But in this case, the actual facts were the defendant possessed a gun.
What about a semi-automatic, though? The person might not necessarily know that the firearm was a semi-automatic and there's an enhancement for semi-automatic. Isn't that a particular fact that really kind of would be more intrinsic?
Yes, that is a particular fact. And I would agree that the pleading has to say the defendant possessed a semi-automatic handgun. I don't think the pleading has to say knowingly possessed a semi-automatic handgun if you're talking about an enhancement. If you're talking about the crime itself, then yes, because 702.204 says that it applies to offenses and states of mind apply to offenses unless the legislative intent exists otherwise. And going to the notice issue, which I think is the strongest argument the state has here, the defendant definitely had notice. By the time we're getting to the second trial, which we haven't done yet, because we already went through a trial.
But along those lines, you did include intentional or knowing in the first go around?
That was included in the jury instructions.
In the jury instructions.
But not in the original charge.
All right. So you're saying that you would include it in the jury instructions, but not in the complaint?
It wasn't included in the indictment.
All right.
And that's something that... That's set in stone, right? We're stuck with that. That's why we're here today. But if you're talking about...
So you're kind of like acknowledging that it needed to be in the instructions.
I don't think it did need to be in the instructions either. I believe the law, as written by the legislature and as intended by the legislature, is the mere possession of a firearm.
Strict liability, no defense.
Yes.
702.28.18, ignorance or mistake as a defense does not apply.
Not to an enhancement, because they've already committed a crime while possessing a firearm. If you read the conference report.
While possessing a firearm, even if they didn't know they had it.
Yes. I think that's 15
years, an additional 15
well,
years.
That's why the legislature carved it out for the first offense and said it may be imposed, because the legislature wanted to punish people for having firearms or committing crimes. That was their goal. That was their intent. That's why in 1987 they changed it from possession of a firearm, possession of and use or threat of a firearm, threat to use a firearm, to possession or use or threat to use a firearm. So they made the enhancement apply more broadly, even without it being used. So to answer your question more directly, I think absolutely the legislature intended if you had a firearm under your car, under your seat when you were in a car that you'd stolen and you crashed it and killed someone, then the enhancement would apply. That's what the legislature wanted. Whether that's fair or not, that's for the people to decide.
I'm sure somebody might raise some Second Amendment concerns with respect to that,
yes.
Right?
You know, the legislature could make a crime murder by firearm.
Many states have something like that.
And can the legislature then sort of circumvent state of mind by calling it a sentencing enhancement when it's really a separate crime, murder by firearm?
My argument is that the legislature decides first that states of mind are required for the elements of the offense, right? That's what 702.204 is about. So if the legislature wanted to create a crime that didn't require states of mind, they could do it. They could amend 702.204, or they could write it specifically in the they could write the carve out, or they could change, like I said, they could change 702.204. They could write it in the statute. This is a strict liability offense, as Mr. Kennedy's arguing, didn't happen here. But I would also point out that when they drafted, as you pointed out, when they drafted the 706 chapter and the enhancements, they included states of mind for some of the enhancements. But they didn't, pointedly, they did not include the state of mind for this enhancement. And I think that speaks to their intent to make this strict liability or to not require a state of mind.
If this court were to rule that state of mind must be pled here, what state of mind do you think would apply? Do you think it would be the intentional or knowingly, as in the underlying offense, as argued by Mr. Kennedy, or do you think it goes down to the recklessly?
I believe because 702.202 defines possession, it doesn't define possession, it defines what a voluntary act of possession is. It includes the knowing possession. I think based on that, there would have to be at least part of the state of mind that includes knowing. I think Mr. Kennedy's right. If you're going to require a state of mind, it's knowingly possessing an object and recklessly disregarding the risk it's a firearm. But I also think it seems to me, based on the definition of 702.202, or not the definition, but when you look at 702.202, it seems saying they knowingly possess something seems also to be redundant if you're looking at the word possession strictly from the legal standpoint that I think Mr. Kennedy's arguing, because possession from the legal standpoint already includes the knowledge that you knew you possessed it. But if you're talking about a layperson,
do you think 702.200 does apply here?
No.
It does say in any prosecution, it is a defense that the conduct alleged does not include a voluntary act or the voluntary omission to perform an act of which the defendant is physically capable.
I believe that, like 702.204, applies to the crimes, but not to the sentencing enhancements.
So you don't think 702.200, you don't think that 702.200 applies to a sentencing enhancement?
I don't know.
It doesn't say in any prosecution for of an offense. It says in any prosecution.
Yes, and that is, I mean, it's possible that they meant to carve that out and make that separate from 702-204. I would suspect, though, given the nature of Chapter 702 and the other material in it, it seems like it's more likely to mean that they meant for it to apply to the crimes themselves. But even if it applies broadly, more broadly than crimes itself, that's another distinguishing difference between that section in 702-204, which specifically only applies to crimes and offenses.
So based on how you see the charge and the offenses here, like with prior convictions, do you believe like there needs to be a bifurcated trial for purposes of the sentencing enhancement?
Not in this particular instance, no. Especially this case, maybe theoretically or hypothetically, there could be a case where it would be necessary, but in this case where he's also charged with not only committing murder with the use of a firearm, but the separate crime of use of a firearm in the commission of a separate felony, I don't think bifurcating it, I don't think would do any good because they're already making that decision alongside the murder charge anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's interesting because prior convictions seem to be a different circumstance, really. I mean, a different, yes. You know, concerns than certainly here. But yet, you're trying to make this distinction between the offense versus the sentencing enhancement. And that's part of what I'm trying to reconcile.
I mean, I'll admit, if I was drafting the statute, or the whole penal code, I might have done it differently. But I'm just one person. Maybe I'm not particularly smart about that as the legislature. But
what's required for the offense may be different than what's required for the enhancement. I mean, I suppose,
yes.
Right? I mean, that's very possible in different circumstances.
And I think that's what makes an enhancement and not an offense standing on its own, right? There has to be some crime already proven before you can even get to an enhancement. And if that's the case, I think the due process standards don't go away, but they're different.
You don't have any dispute with the idea that you have to submit to the jury the facts to establish the enhancement?
No dispute with that. I mean, that's established case law federally and statewide. Right. So,
well, and we have instructions on that too.
Right.
In fact, we have instructions with respect to elderly, handicapped, underage minors. Such disability is known or reasonably should be known to the defendant. That's a state of mind, isn't it?
Yes.
Hate crimes, 706-662-6. The defendant intentionally selected a victim. That's a state of mind.
Yes, and that's in the statute.
And would you agree that in those particular situations, the charging document should include a state of mind?
Yes, it should, or there should be notice given to the defendant in some way that satisfies the notice requirement. Although, again, if we're looking at the element, the statute itself, if the statute requires state of mind, even if the defendant has notice otherwise, maybe the charge is still in violation of the statute, in which case it might still be subject to, you know, dismissal. I could see that, but I don't think that's the case here because the statute doesn't require it and there's notice.
So if the statute does have for an enhancement, a state of mind, that should be embedded in the charging document. But in situations where there is no state of mind that the legislature has embedded into a sentencing enhancement, then it's unnecessary to include a state of mind.
Yes.
And that's your situation, isn't it?
Exactly. It's unnecessary. It's not required, however you want to phrase it.
And do you think that a defendant without that state of mind that's non-existent has sufficient notice to defend against the charge? Because there's a difference between defending against the charge and then actually, or understanding the charge, rather, and proving the charge.
Yes. I mean, notice is something that has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. I wouldn't categorically say in every case if a charge is written this certain way, then the defendant has guaranteed to have notice. Probably there are certain ways you can write a charge to give everyone notice, for sure. But I don't know I think those are two separate questions, and I think the notice question has to be taken on a case-by-case basis.
The Chief Justice asked Mr. Kennedy a question about the whole scope of the charging document and how that might impact notice. What's your position on that?
Well, this court has said repeatedly, I believe, that when you're looking at the sufficiency of a charge, you have to look at the entire document, the entire indictment, because something in a different charge could give notice or provide that notice to the defendant about a separate charge. And in this case in particular, that's very clearly there. He's charged with murder and with the enhancement of possession or use of a firearm. Separately, he's charged with using a firearm in the commission of a separate felony, murder. So I think there's...
But the using charge does have a state of mind.
Yes, it does, because it's required by statute.
Are you arguing that because using is included in the other separate charge, he should know that state of mind is also required for this sentencing enhancement?
Well, I'm not arguing the state of mind is required, but I am arguing that he has notice as to what he has to meet at trial based on the other charges.
So you're conceding that he has to meet a state, there has to be a state of mind then, as instructed. I assume that you requested or agreed to the instruction that included intentionally or knowingly in the first trial?
The state did, I believe, submit the jury instructions as read to the
jury. So you submitted an instruction with intentionally or knowingly in the first trial, but it is your position, and then the second trial, you're not going to do it because you don't need to do it. If this court were to agree with you that you, if you didn't appeal in the second trial, you would have, well, it was already dismissed, right? That's why you had to appeal, yeah. Right?
Again, I think there's a difference between the notice required and the charge or notice of what he faces at trial and what's required in the jury instruction.
So, but you're saying that if a person, you have to prove more, which is included in the jury instruction, the defendant is not entitled to notice of that. And if they don't have notice of the fact that at trial, the state has to prove more, would a defendant who enters into a plea have really understood the charge against him?
I mean, that raises an issue. If intentional or knowing is required, and a defendant enters a plea without that there, I mean, that could be a problem for many cases that have come before this one. I don't know, you know, the full scope of the cases, but I believe the state, when it submitted those jury instructions, was being overly cautious. I don't think intentional knowing is required in the jury instructions. We're talking about the enhancement.
Do you think a voluntary act of possession is required?
I don't think that's what the legislature intended for the enhancement.
Okay. So you don't think the voluntary act possession statute
applies? They say, the way I read the legislative intent, it was, in their own words, mere possession.
But I hear you basically, and those are two different things, the notice and then the back end on the conviction, that if we actually ever got a case that a person was convicted sort of under the, maybe one of the hypotheticals that Justice McKenna was mentioning, that in that situation there might be a due process violation, which wouldn't relate to the notice issue.
I mean, yes, I could see that being a separate, I think that would be a separate issue, and I'm not comfortable, guessing at what might be the right answer.
You don't like hypotheticals like backpacks? What about the backpack example that Mr. Kennedy brought up, which was, that was a nice start. What's your position with respect to his hypo there?
What was it again? I'm sorry. It was...
The person had a backpack, didn't know a firearm was in it.
They steal the backpack, or do they just pick up the backpack? I think those are also questions that matter. If the person has a backpack that their friends just put a gun in, let's say, and so they're walking down the street, how is anyone going to know there's a gun in the backpack? There's no crime that's occurring where they will be found to have possessed that gun. If they stole the backpack and there happened to be a gun in it, now they're committing a felony, probably, theft of a firearm, although they don't have knowledge that there's a firearm in it. But let's say they stole the backpack because they knew it had $1,000 worth of goods in it or something. So they have a felony on that.
Well, what if he had a backpack and went into a store and stole something over $20,000?
And then police arrested him, found the backpack mm-hmm. and the gun in it. I think the legislature's intent there would be that he face the consequences of committing a crime
and possessing a firearm that was in his backpack yes. that his friend had put in and he didn't know.
I think that's the way I read the intent of the legislature, yes. Wait, again, so, I don't know if it's fair, but that's their decision.
So your argument on the legislature's intent of imposing absolute liability, that's based on the statute being silent?
It's based on the statute being silent, where other statutes do include mens rea, and yeah, as
the,
well
the
as...
The statute isn't really silence. It's using the word possession.
It does use the word
possession. Possession relates back to knowingly.
If you think that 702.202's definition of voluntary act includes possession also as the same kind of possession, the legislature...
Why wouldn't it be?
Because they didn't specifically indicate that it had to be a voluntary act in the... when they passed the statute. If you read the conference committee reports, they say that it's any possession of a firearm while committing an offense should be punished harshly. That's what they wanted. That's what they were seeking. They had a carve out for the first offense in the sense the judge may impose it depending on the facts of the specific case. So to take Justice McKenna's example, if a guy had a backpack, his friend put a gun in it, and he goes and robs a store, not knowing he had a gun in the backpack, but that's found, that's something a judge could consider under the statute to not impose the mandatory minimum. I think that's what the legislature's intent was.
And that plainly appears by silence?
It's silent, which means I think the court is entitled to look into the legislative history, including the conference committee reports, where that is specifically there.
Thank you.
You know, the ICA really relied heavily on Wagner. In your view, does the analysis of Wagner survive the Auld decision? Because there is a footnote in Wagner that talks about the Auld decision being prospective. So to the extent that it you have a set of facts to which Auld would apply, what's the status of Wagner at that point?
I feel like Wagner still survives Auld. But I also don't think even Auld or Wagner's state of mind it comes into play. So even if Wagner didn't survive Auld, I don't believe state of mind is required for this.
Well, Wagner talked about just the mere fact of a prior conviction, right under the meth trafficking. That's different.
Yes.
Would you agree?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's just plus prior convictions are an exception to Apprendi. And it's different in many ways.
But all seem to get away from the prior conviction exemption.
Yeah.
So how do you square that?
I think Wagner was right in recognizing that sentencing enhancements are different than elements of an offense. Even if Apprendi and Alain said that they are elements that have to be charged, that's not the same as saying they're an element of the offense itself.
And Auld and Wagner were talking about two different enhancement
yes.
statutes. Thank you.
And then we get back to what Justice Scalia was saying. He doesn't see the distinction between, you know, calling it elements or sentencing factors or sentencing enhancements, because a legislature could then just say, hey, here's the basic offense. And then after that, everything is a sentencing enhancement. And you're saying the legislature could do that, that the legislature could just say, hey, you know, we're going to have these offenses that require state of mind, but we're going to call everything else a sentencing enhancement and not require any state of mind.
I think
that's constitutional.
I'm not sure. I wouldn't say blatantly it's constitutional in every scenario, but I do believe the legislature has the power to negate, to do away with states of mind.
Well, shouldn't we read the statute? If we find some constitutional infirmity, shouldn't we read the statute to save it from that infirmity?
if that's the case, if the court finds that the statute is infirm in some way and there's a way to read it to save it, then, you know, precedent says that's what the court's supposed to do. But I don't think the court should take a Supreme Court case interpreted by this court in a different circumstance and use that as a way to rewrite a statute to change the intent that the legislature originally had.
You know, you've conceded that if we were to find a state of mind required, and if it was possession, it would need to be knowingly under 702, but what if it's threatened its use, right? Threaten the use. Let's say that it was, someone had what they thought was an air gun, but it ended up being a real gun. And they say, hey, hand over your nice watch there, or I have a gun and I'm going to use it, right? And then he's arrested. Ends up that it wasn't an air gun, it was a real gun. So if we were to find a state of mind, would that still be knowingly?
I think he knowingly possessed the object, reckless disregard, it was an actual gun. Like Mr. Kennedy said, I think that would cover that scenario.
Okay, thank you.
Well, anything further for the court?
No, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Murray. Mr. Kennedy, your rebuttal.
If I may briefly, a lot of time was spent on legislative intent. I just want to reiterate that there's a presumption that state of mind exists. You know, we don't say it speaks to their intent. It has to be clear. 702.212, it has to be clear that state of mind does not exist. We presume that the state of mind exists. And yes, the legislature can do away with the state of mind, but they have to expressly do it. And there's nothing in the legislative history that says that they contemplated that this should be a strict liability offense. And there's nothing in the statute that says that there no state of mind exists. And I do fall back on, this is not necessarily before the court, but even if no state of mind exists, it should still be pled. People should know that particular aspect of their charge or the accusation doesn't apply. Another thing that was brought up was that the strongest argument was notice due to the first trial, although I think the court has heard, the first trial is where this confusion came from, because they used one set of jury instructions that didn't totally comply with what Jenkins was, and now they're arguing it's something totally different. So if anything, the first trial shows how important the notice actually is for us to know what we have to defend against. The fact that that was a position the state took, that an experienced circuit court judge adopted, that is different than what either of the attorneys are arguing today. I know the issue was brought up on bifurcation and whether this would have to be bifurcated. So just to touch, I would agree that this is a little different than the Wagner situation or persistent offender situation. This has enough overlapping evidence. It's the type of evidence that comes in the case in chief. So I don't think bifurcation is necessary in this type of situation. I think those other ones, it's almost the goal to keep the other act evidence out. Mm-hmm. And that's why we bifurcate it. That doesn't appear to be the case in this. So I don't think bifurcation is something that would obviously a defense attorney could ask for it, make an argument. That could be a discussion for a different day, but that's not something we were intending to do. And with that said, if there's questions or follow-up otherwise. All right. Well, thank you very much for hearing the argument.
Thank you to both our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
And there is one more matter to address before we depart the courtroom. Unless something else comes up, we have just concluded Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald's last oral argument. Chief Justice Rechtenwald joined this court as an Associate Justice in May 2009 after serving for 2 years as Chief Judge of the Intermediate Court of Appeals. He assumed the position of Chief Justice on August 13, 2010, in the midst of an economic downturn. Since then, not only has he ably led the judiciary through various challenges, including furlough Fridays, the COVID pandemic, and attacks on judicial independence, he has led the judiciary with integrity, grace, fairness and compassion, and leaves behind a strong and diverse judiciary that has become a national leader in access to justice, state constitutionalism, specialty courts, including our therapeutic and environmental courts, and of course, the Aloha Spirit. For the past 14 years, I have been deeply honored to serve as a member of the Recktenwald Court. On behalf of all current and former members of the Recktenwald Court, as well as everyone here and everyone who has served in the Hawaii State Judiciary, past and present, mahalo nui loa, Chief Justice Recktenwald. Aloha and a hui ho. Would everyone please rise to acknowledge Chief Justice Mark E. Recktenwald as I present a lei on behalf of everyone.
Say something really quick. You know, I honestly, I didn't realize this was my last oral argument, so which kind of tells you how busy it's been. But every time I walk, it never gets old walking into this room to preside over an oral argument, and it's really sort of our judiciary at its finest, with justices well prepared, asking tough questions, and trying to get to the truth and trying to decide matters correctly. And for me, it's been absolutely the joy of a lifetime to have this opportunity to be here in this role and also in my role as Chief Justice. And the friendships I've had and developed, professional relationships I've developed, are things that I will treasure forever. And so I am deeply, deeply touched by this really incredible outpouring of aloha today. So thank you all so very, very much. Aloha.
Ua hoku ia mai ne kea aha ho kolo kolo ki ke aha. This Honorable Supreme Court said the word is now adjourned.